Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Jeff A. from Reading, PA.
Can we delay this till next week? Or anything we can do? Thanks for having me tonight. I'm amazed at the amount of people that are here. I have no idea what I'm about to say, but I guess that's the best way to do it. We'll let God figure it out. In talking for a couple minutes before the meeting, someone says, you know, any funny liners or a joke? And I thought, well, let me start off with a little joke, see if we can lighten things up a little before I get started. And there was a little kid named Joey, and comes from this nice Italian family. And I come from a nice Italian family also. We'll get into that. But little Joey wanted a little red bicycle for Christmas, and he wanted it so bad that he thought, well, if I write a letter to God, God will give me what I want. So he writes a letter, starts writing a letter to God. Dear God, I've been a really good boy this year, and I really think you should give me a little red bicycle with a little bell. Thinks for a moment, he goes, no, God knows, he knows everything. He knows I haven't been a good boy, so he crumbles it up and throws it away. So he's thinking for a while and thinking for a while, and he says, Dear God, if you give me a little red bicycle with a little bell and the things, I'll be a really good boy all year long, I promise. And he goes, God's not a sucker. He just knows. He ain't going to fall for that. God knows it all. He knows my patterns. He knows everything. Throws it away. So this kid is racking his mind for hours and hours and hours. And finally, it gets almost like a light bulb goes off inside his head. He runs downstairs, gets a statue of the Virgin Mary. And every nice Italian house has a statue of the Virgin Mary. takes upstairs, wraps it in newspaper, sticks it in his trunk in the back of the attic. Big smile on his face, comes back down, sits at the desk, he says, Dear God, if you ever want to see your mother again. So there we go. Start off on a light note. And it's funny about that joke because in a lot of ways it resembles my life. I come from a nice Italian family. I've always looked to bargain and negotiate with God to get what I want, attempted every way to manipulate, and when I could and tried to intimidate and finagle and do everything I can to get what I wanted, only learning as we come along here in recovery that what I want might not always be what's best for me. And but in growing up, we lived in Reading, I grew up in Reading, and lived at 819 Greenwich Street. And it was a nice little neighborhood. And for all practical purposes, we were a nice family from the outside. We wouldn't see anything wrong with it. But what I've come to learn throughout my recovery is that I grew up in a family that was wounded by alcoholism. Looking back, both grandfathers were strong alcoholics, what we would consider, alcoholics. They were functioning alcoholics. They went to work every day. They provided for their family. But when they weren't working, they were drinking. That's what they spent their life doing. And they weren't available for their family on any level other than financially. And that's hard to say. It's hard to say that about your family. But that's the truth. And so then with my mother and father, they're both children of alcoholics. And they grew up in that environment. And my father pretty much drank alcoholically until he met my mom. And then decided, I need to have a family, and so I need to stop. I need to be strong and carry on and buck up and do the right thing. So he would get drunk once or twice a year. And he'd drink once or twice a year, but every time he drank, he got drunk, and things would get pretty crazy. And the times when he wasn't drinking and things were crazy at home, his remark was, I can't believe I stopped drinking. I should just go back to drinking because this is what I gave it up for. And so in that environment of whether it's remorse, my mom was always being a victim, the fighting between them, and all this was going on, and I had an older brother that was 9 years older than me. There was a lot of insanity in that house. And there was really no place for me, a 4 or 5 year old, because I was just pretty much alone by myself. So I had to figure out life as I could see it. And one of my first primary memories was I was in school, you know, again, the con. We came up with this thing, second grade. Me and these other kids came up with this thing that when you empty the trash can, you got to go through the teacher's lounge. And when you go through the teacher's lounge, there's boxes of candy with their honor thing to put a dime or a nickel in for the candy. So we say, "Hi, Mrs. So-and-so, we'll empty the trash." And we go down, we grab a pack of candy, or grab a pack of gum, or grab whatever we grab. But sooner or later, we get caught. And I'm sitting there in the principal's office, and I still remember this. There's an American flag out over the window, and I remember kneeling in that chair waiting for my parents to come in. And this is the first memory that I really have of unmanageability in my life, not knowing it then, but looking back. Really looking out over that street, looking out over that American flag, thinking to myself in second grade, like, where do I, this American flag and life and this whole thing that we're supposed to be doing, like, where do I fit into this? Who am I? What's my role here? And I didn't have those exact words, but that's the feeling that I was feeling. I was feeling lost. I was feeling alone. I was feeling abandoned. I was feeling insecure. Unaware of what was going on around me, I was just in my little world of survival. Second grade, living a little world of survival. And that's what I was doing. I was surviving. I learned to survive as that child in that home of insanity, that for all practical purposes, when you walk out the front door, everything looked nice. Working parents, clean house, blah, 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 blah. Add your own little things to it, and it all looks good. And so my parents came and we got through it, and I really don't know what happened. All I remember is that moment. And then another time in we had this coat room, and it was the same thing. It was about a year later. I just kind of remember in there just feeling so alone, so out of place. Where do I fit in with these kids? You know, who am I? I had no clue of my identity. And that's how it went throughout my childhood, because I spent my childhood looking back again, trying to run away and find a place to hide. And that was long before a drink. I found, well, if I took some money out of my mom and dad's pocketbook, I could go play the pinball machine for hours and not think about all the things that were going on in my head. And I came to find, when I look back again, that I was living this little life all alone, because my brother was very abusive. And so it was very hard for me to be home when my mom and dad weren't working, and they were working a lot. So I would just kind of be out in this little world at, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, just by myself, trying to kind of figure out, what's this all about? What am I supposed to be doing? How can I occupy myself till it's safe to go home again? And then even when it's safe to go home again, it's not really safe, because mom and dad are fighting. There's all kinds of stuff going on. You never really know what's going to happen. So you go hide in the bedroom and just kind of hang out and wait for the next day and do it all over again. So, you know, as time went on, I got to be about 10, 12, 11, 12 years old, and that's when I first discovered alcohol. I based on what I just talked about, I was predisposed, ready for that first drink. I was an alcoholic waiting to happen. And so, you know, we did the thing that we usually do. You get a six-pack of beer and you split it between your buddies. You drink and then you throw up and you say, "That wasn't that great." And you all fall asleep. And then you say, "We got to do that again. It was wonderful." And, you know, again, the insanity of that. But that's what we did. And so that went on every once in a great while. But all I can remember prior to the throwing up was, this feels good. This kind of feels like I belong. That music really sounds pretty good, and I'm over here talking, and I feel like I fit in with the guys. And then later on, as the time goes on, you go into this place called a cantina. It was a dance on Friday nights at the one church, every Friday night or once a month. And, you know, you have a beer or two before you go in there, or you have a shot of something or some wine. And all of a sudden, I'm Casanova with the girls. I'm able to talk. I'm able to do all these things. And that was the setup for me. The setup for me was that this little bottle with whatever is in it is going to change my life and fix me and make me okay. So I spent the next 11 years chasing that feeling of wanting to be okay and wanting to be stable and wanting to fit in. And as most of us know, each time I took those drinks, life became a little more unmanageable. And I could rationalize it and justify it for 3, 4, 5 years. The fun went on, the fun with the guys and all the kind of stuff. And I got involved in a lot of things during that time that I never would have known that I would have been involved in, that my parents would have never thought I would be involved in. And that's where the shame that I had learned growing up, that's really where it started to kick in. Because the behavior, the way I was behaving, was not a good kid. The things that I was doing, whatever I was doing, I was out using other things other than alcohol and all the things that are involved with getting those things and participating in all the criminal activity that goes on with that. And I see how my life completely changed. My life completely changed. I was this kid that was wanting some dreams and had some thoughts of what he wanted to be when he grew up to, again, surviving. And by the time I was 15 or 16 is when it really started getting out of control, because that's when I started getting arrested and trying to con mom and dad into that it really wasn't a problem. Because prior to then, I could just con them that it was okay. But once I started getting arrested, it became pretty clear that it wasn't okay and that I was doing more than what I was telling them. And in my family, there was expectations, as there is with every family. And one of the expectations is, if you're going to do something, you don't get caught. So, yeah. So not only was I doing what I shouldn't be doing, because I could be doing other things, that would have been okay. But doing the things I was doing, that was outside the shadow of the family's okayness. And then I end up getting caught on top of that. So now I'm still just trying to live inside this little world, and I became more and more and more completely isolated from my family on an emotional level. I would check in. I'd be there at Sunday dinner. I'd try and say all the right things, but I was always back out the door. And now by 15, 16, I'm completely in my own little world, a little world that I thought was the only world that existed out there. And the drinking continued to completely spiral out of control because I stopped going to school. My buddy would be sitting there in his brother's 56 Chevy, and he'd say, "Well, is it there or the distributor? Where do you want to go?" I says, "Well, let's go to the distributor." The distributors, I don't know what they call it down here. That's where they stole the cases of beer. And we could get there early because they opened an hour before the state store opened. And then once the state store opened, we'd go there. And then in that 56 Chevy, we were cruising through the mountains throughout the day and then go home and pretend that I'd been at school all day. And again, this charade only lasts so long because sooner or later the grades come home and the teachers are calling and all these kind of things are happening. And eventually, I have a choice. I can either change my ways or I'm going to be basically expelled from school. 11th grade, they said, "You have a choice. We can help you or you got to go." And my parents just sat there with their hands going, "What do you want to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to actually follow through with?" I says, "Well, I'm not going to follow through with this." They says, "Well, then you got to do what you got to do." And that was the end of it. And I, again, went on my way. So my addiction continued to win over and over and over again. It was nonstop. My addiction kept winning, but getting stronger and taking me down and down and down. And so throughout this time, I was in a pretty crazy relationship. And the friends of mine that we were having so much fun with We're slowly dying off, one at a time, sometimes not so slowly. And the arrests were happening more frequently, and the people that I'm with are becoming more and more insane. And this, I'm sure many people here can relate, becomes a world that I never thought that I'd be in. And one of the turning points that didn't stay a turning point, but one of the turning points, I had got arrested, I had got a choice. You got to go away for a while. We worked it out. I'm going to go here. And I'm on my way to work. I had got a job to kind of fill in the time in between then because I got to go away. Let me just go do that for a while. I got a job. And I'm on the way to work. And right outside of a friend's house, there was the police and the ambulances and all these kind of things. And I said, "What's going on?" He says, well, you know, Peggy died last night. I says, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "I was just here last night. I was here. We did this. We did that. Blah, blah, blah. I went home." And I'm trying to rationalize, just trying to figure it out. And this guy, Michael, says to me, "Look, Jeff, this is the reality. Peggy's dead. That's it. It's the way it is. And we got to accept it." And that phrase had stuck in my head to this day. This is the reality. Because I was a champion at avoiding reality. I was a champion at making life, pretend life to be what I wanted it to be, as opposed to be what it really was. I could always make it better, twist it around, make it what it's not really is, find the upside to everything. And that was a moment where I walked to work, I did my work, I came back, and we went through the whole process, the viewing and the funeral and all those kind of things. And it was sad because Peggy had committed suicide. And part of the reason she committed suicide because of the lifestyle that we were living. You know, her boyfriend was doing a lot of things that put him in jail for a long time. And he'd get out and then be back in jail for a long time again. And now he's going to be there for a long time. And she was tired. And she just wanted to go to sleep. And, you know, the night before, we had talked about, I had this, she had that. You want to trade this, you want to trade that. Oh, cool, let's trade this and that. And by the time the next day came around, it hit me what the trade was part of. You know, it was a contributor, too. She wanted to make sure that she wasn't waking up in the morning. And she took enough to make sure that she would never wake up again. And it was very painful because the way she died was very painful. Some of the things that came to light, her son was in the room, and that was a real dose of reality for me. But it didn't wake me up. I went to the place that I went to, and I had some real moments of clarity there. I was 18 years old. I just turned 18 there. There were some counselors there. There was a lot of things available to me. And I had some moments of clarity, and I was recalling one to my wife. I remember standing out in this cement thing, deck thing, and I had quit smoking because I was smoking 2 packs a day, and it was killing me. 18 is killing me. You know what I mean? I couldn't take it anymore. My lungs, I was like, I can't do this anymore. I stopped, and I was maybe about a week or two clean from the cigarettes. And it was this beautiful sunrise or sunset. It was just this beautiful, there was trees and it was magnificent. And for this moment, I was in touch with God. I didn't know it at the time, but I knew it was a special moment. I knew it was special. So there was all the ingredients for a life-changing experience for me. There was a spiritual experience. There was counselors available. It was everything I needed to change my life and take a different course. But I chose not to do that. Instead, I chose to get involved with, there were 7 of us that could kind of run the place and figure out how to get things in the mail, because one of us would get the mail and he'd put it aside and we'd do this, and there were honorees and trustees and we'd go out on the walk. And so instead, I chose to run the con and play the game and be a part of the game once again. I had the moment. It was there waiting for me. But instead I chose to take the path that seemed more fun, It seemed more exciting. It seemed more interesting. And that took me back home and took me down a new path, a continued path of great pain and sorrow. Because for those next 5 years, I watched many more people die. I just watched them go one by one. I watched Charlie walk into a telephone booth because he was distraught, call his girlfriend and, you know, shot himself. You know, I watched people go off a bridge. I watched people fall off a balcony, all from drinking. Many people committing suicide just over and over and over again. People ODing. And people dying in car crashes, in fiery car crashes. And it was painful to watch. It was painful to watch. What didn't occur to me at the time was, this is the reality of your life. This is the reality of the path that you're choosing. I watched friends get murdered by other friends. The insanity. You know, a guy who shoots his girlfriend in the head and kicks her out of the car as he's driving because he's whacked out on meth on New Year's Day. You know, and I'm at my grandmother's house, and they're reading the paper saying, did you see what happened on 10th Street? The guy he kills and kicks. And I got to keep my mouth shut because, yeah, I know. I know, Grandma. I know. And that was hard. It was hard to live that double life, the double life of pain and sorrow that was in the bottle of Amaretto or the bottle of Southern Comfort or in the case of Michelob or the case of Budweiser or whatever we could get our hands on that was always there supposedly to fix us and to make us better and to take us out of the pain that we are in when really all it did was cause more pain every time. All it did was another ticket to more pain. And that takes me basically to, you know, I'm 23 years old, and I'm done. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I'm burnt out. I'm fried. I've had it. I've completely had it. I've been trying to kill myself for years, probably from the time I was about 20, 21, putting myself in situations that maybe I'd get killed. But the survivor in me always gets myself out. And walking down the street in the middle of the night on the wrong way, so that in the dark, on a dark road, so that maybe somebody will take me out while I'm walking and I don't have to do it myself. Driving my motorcycle without a headlight on a dark road. And it just goes on and on and on and on. How many times, you know, have we done that? So many different ways to take myself out so that I can get out of this, so it can be over, so I can be done. And that didn't happen. It seemed like God had a different plan for me. So one weekend, I got this idea that I got to go, man. It's got to be done. It's got to be over. I got to get out of here. I can't do it anymore. And so I got a bunch of pills together, and I took all those pills. But apparently my tolerance had been so high that even this huge amount of pills that I took didn't work. I woke up to the next day to my mom telling me my girlfriend's on the phone. I'm going, I had planned this so perfectly. I'd gotten everything out of the house. I took it away so it wouldn't reflect on my parents. I'd cleaned everything up. I had taken care of everything. And it didn't work. And so I says, I got to do this. It's got to be done. And there was something going on at the house, and I was in such bad shape from everything that I took. I was shaking. It was very toxic, everything that I took. I could hardly walk, but I didn't die. And so I went downstairs, and there was a letter opener there. And I took it, and I broke the handle off because I wanted to make it as long as possible. And I took it and I stuck it through my chest 4 times and kept trying to put it through my heart. But each time I'd stick it in, it didn't work. So I guess I missed. So I figured, well, let me pull it out. Maybe I'll bleed and it'll be over. And it didn't work. And I again and again and again and again until I couldn't take it anymore. My lung was collapsed. I could barely breathe, but not enough to die. Insanity, right? Insanity. And I'm laying there once again. This is where my best thinking has taken me. Laying here with a letter opener in my chest. I can't breathe. I can't walk. I can't really do anything. And somehow, I don't remember how I did it, but I managed to get my parents' attention. And they got me to a hospital. They took me to the hospital. They put me in the intensive care ward. Somehow brought me back to shape. And said, you need help. You need help, brother. You need it bad. And of course, I says, well, it really isn't. You see, if he would only, everything would be fine. And of course, they weren't buying that. And the funny thing, I don't know what was going on, but I think it's crazy. This is crazy. But I think at night there was this girl who might have been an addict. And I think she was taking my medication. Because I wasn't getting my medication at night because I was in such pain. So I wasn't getting medication. I was supposed to get every 2 hours. And I really think that she was stealing it. She was one of us. And so the next shift came around, and I says, please, I could still hardly talk. Please, you got to help me. I need something for the pain. I know I'm where I'm at, blah, 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 but can you help me out here? I don't need to punish me. And she goes, why doesn't this man have his medication? Where's this man's medication? I go, oh, this one's for me. I got to get close to this one because she's going to take good care of me. And the funny thing is, she's the one that would sit by my bed and say, why don't you go? Just give it a try. What harm could it do? And I listened to her. At some point, I listened to her because she got me my dope. I listened to her. So it's kind of a miracle the way things work out. The addict takes my stuff. So I get this lady. I trust her. And she's the one that helps me get help. So it's kind of funny how God works in mysterious ways. And so I go to the psychiatric ward. Ah, blah, blah, blah. You need to go to treatment. No, no, no. I'm okay. Here we go. So this goes on for 13 or 14 days. And finally I agree and I go. And I end up in recovery. And I end up at a treatment center. I spent 42 days there. And this was my new chance. This was my new chance for a recovery, for an awakening, for something different. And I didn't get it. I thought, well, if I just stop all the other stuff, I could still have a drink. I could still have a beer now and then. Isn't that okay? And they proceeded to take 42 days to try and talk some sense into me. And by the time I got out of there, my head was still pretty scrambled, but somehow I started to get it. And you know what? I forgot to say, hi, everybody. My name's Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. I forgot about that. So just to make that clear, right? I got to start over. There you go. So by the time I got home, I got to go to these AA meetings. Okay, let's go see what that's about. I went to a couple up there. I went up to our clubhouse, and there was these guys there. I says, I'm looking for this place, the big book meeting, and you're in the right place. Sit down. And from that moment on, just as it was at the treatment center, from that moment on, everybody welcomed me with open arms. And they were always there. They were always available to me. And so I spent the next 6 months toying with the idea of still using and doing other things. And I dabbled a little here and dabbled a little there, but always felt completely shameful and guilty about it. And I believe it was November 17th, 1981, when I finally made, that was my anniversary. I had stopped doing it. I had stopped everything. The last thing I did was I got some pills from somebody at a bus stop. It was just crazy. They're going like, "Yeah, I just hurt my tooth, and they gave me these pills. I don't know what they are." Well, let me tell you. I'll tell you what they are. Here, let me see. Can I have a couple of them? Oh, thank you very much. It's nice to see you. And get on the bus. I held onto those pills for months, but I'm not going to take them. And one night I took them. And as soon as I took them, I got on the knees and I prayed to God. I says, "God, what am I doing? This is insane. Why am I doing this? This is insanity. And just help me get through this." And from that point on, I stayed clean. And I went to meetings and I took care of a lot of things inside. I learned about my shame and I learned about my guilt. I learned about the way I grew up. I learned about the insanity of my childhood. I learned about all the ghosts that I carried with me. I learned that I had post-traumatic stress syndrome. I had survivor's guilt. I had all this kind of stuff. And I needed to do something more than just go to meetings. I needed to really work the steps. I needed to dive in. Head first, both feet, dive off the cliff, whatever it takes. I got to do what it takes, because just going to meetings, just hanging out in the fellowship, going to dances, making coffee, that's really good stuff. That's wonderful. But Jeff, you need to do more, because this isn't enough. You need to go further. You need to understand the first step. You need to understand the second step. You need to understand, what is your higher power? What are you about? You need to do your personal inventory. You need to sit down with your fourth step. And by the time I got to that fourth step, I was working with my sponsor, but my sponsor, I was in this relationship because, again, as I got clean, I thought, well, all I need is a good woman and a nice relationship, and my life will be fine. That's all I need. You have a nice little family, everything's good, everything's okay. So I call my sponsor, and I say, "Oh, this girl, she's doing this, and she's doing that, and she's doing blah, 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 blah." And at some point, he says to me, "Look," he says, "I don't want you to call me anymore." "What? You don't want me to call him?" "I don't want you to call him anymore unless you've completed your fourth step, or you're going to drink. If you're going to drink or jump off a bridge or something like that, feel free to call me. But other than that, unless you complete your fourth step, don't call me anymore." So he got my attention. So it's back to, this is reality. This isn't a game. This is truth. So I completed that fourth step. And we did the fifth. Focused on six and seven the best I could at, a year clean. And eight and nine, made my amends to the best I could at that time. And went on, daily inventory, 11th step, out helping other people, making coffee, cleaning up ashtrays, chairs, going on 12-step calls. And eventually, I started working at a treatment center. Eventually, I started working as a therapist. Eventually, I started doing all kinds of things that I was helping different people. And it was good that I was doing that. But the thing that I learned as I was doing that was, as I got involved in that type of work, I got involved at a couple years clean, but I still didn't fully take care of myself. I didn't take care of me thoroughly to be able to be doing that type of thing. So I got out of it, and I started doing, my family, we fixed up houses and stuff like that, and I started building a business for myself, fixing up houses. And while I was doing that, I was still working my program. I did another fourth step. I did another sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth, and continued to take care of myself in other ways, going to some other 12-step meetings, and really trying to find out what's going on with me. But as time went on, I got involved with a business and I had a family. And once again, I started going off the path. I wasn't drinking, but I wasn't living a manageable life. I was working. I was providing. I was being a father. I was doing all those things that society tells me I need to do. And my family told me is most important. You got to be a good provider. You got to be a good father. You got to do all these things. So I'm doing it. I'm sober. I'm clean. Doing all these great things. But you know what? I wasn't taking care of myself. And that's a real slow process of not taking care of myself. Because it's funny, you don't. For me, I don't just stop taking care of myself one day and 3 days later pick up a drink. I just start doing other things. Going to work all the time, not going to meetings. I'm going to meetings, but I'm not going as much as I used to. I'm just going Friday night, or I'm not doing 12-step as much as I used to. And all those things start happening. So you start getting obsessed with other things, just little things. Well, let me look at cars. Let me do this. Let me do that. And the obsession becomes all these other things other than recovery. So I'm not drinking, but I'm really not all that available for my kids. I'm really not all that available for my family because I'm consumed. I'm consumed with the insanity of illness, of alcoholism. I'm just not drinking. Am I still going to meetings? Yeah, I still go to meetings. What's the problem? Am I doing 12 steps? Yeah, still doing 12 steps calls. What's the problem? Working my steps? Yeah, what's the problem? I'm working my steps. But the reality is that I've lost my primary goal. My primary goal is taking care of me. My focus is me. Taking care of the fact that I'm feeling shameful because I'm not good enough. That I'm feeling unworthy because I still never really found that worthiness because I tried to fill it up with other things. That I'm basically a loser because I'll never be okay because that's the way I still feel about myself. Because I never really resolved those issues. I just kind of kept pretending that everything's going to be okay. Because it's going to be. Doesn't it look okay? We have a nice car now. We have a nice house now. And everything looks okay, just like the way I grew up. And that was the key for me, is I needed to go back and start finding out a little bit more about how I grew up. Because that's where all the answers were. All the answers were there inside of me. And I needed to change that belief system that supported my alcoholism. It wasn't my alcoholism, but it supported my alcoholism. It was there, and it was the foundation for my alcoholism. Yes, I'm an alcoholic. If I pick up a drink, I will get drunk. And I will have an allergy to that drink because my physical allergy will take over. But prior to that, I have a mental obsession. And even though I'm not mentally obsessing on a drink, I'm mentally obsessing on other things. And why am I mentally obsessing on other things is because I feel like a piece of crap about myself. And I still haven't fully taken care of that. I did my fourth step, I did my fifth step, but I haven't been as thorough as I needed to be. And so time goes on. You know, fast forward 10 years, and the house of cards that I had built, which was wonderful, starts to fall apart. My financial house, I had built a business, a nice business of building and developing. But my primary focus was to make sure everybody else was happy. That was my purpose. I had to keep all the guys working. I had to keep everybody taken care of. I had to keep feeding the monster, keep feeding the monster. And by doing that, I lost track of the primary purpose, which the primary purpose is to take care of me, take care of my family, take care of the things that are important. And I lost it. I lost it all. I lost it all, ended up going through a divorce, lost the family. And that was devastating to me because here I am in recovery. I'm living a good life. I'm not hurting anybody. I'm living an honest living. And my life is falling apart. What's the matter with me? As time goes on, when I didn't think that things could get any worse, I found out that I had a brain tumor. And that was where it really completely spiraled out of control for me. Because by that point, I had been in so much pain. I had been in a lot of pain for a while. I had bad headaches for years. And I was always trying to just work through it. Be strong. Pull yourself up. Be a man. Work through it. Work through it. Work through it. And I did that for so long until I couldn't take it anymore. And I started taking some medication. And that medication was helpful to me because I had a brain tumor. We took care of that. It did some damage. But it created a lot of pain. So I had to take that medication because it was very helpful for that. But what it did was it stole my soul. just like a bottle of Amaretto or a bottle of Southern Comfort or a case of beer would do. And I had taken that for 3 or 4 years. And I had really slipped into pretty much of a deep depression with that. And a lot of things happened during that time. Even at the beginning of starting to take that medication, I was still trying to do my best in recovery. You know, I remember getting my 20-year coin and celebrating that 20-year anniversary. But over time, I just really let go of everything because I gave up hope. I gave up hope that I was going to have any real life anymore because my life consisted of complete pain and complete misery and complete depression. You know, throughout that, I had met my second wife and my daughter, and we were trying to build a life. And it was very painful for them because they watched as our life was spinning out of control. Because I was lost. I was consumed. I was in the midst of an addiction, even though I didn't attempt to be involved in an addiction. And that was the insanity of it, is I didn't go looking to get high. But I was physically addicted to a medication that was taking the life out of me. You know, I never picked up that drink, but everything else was like I was in an active addiction. And as time went on, I was once again back at that place where I can't live this way anymore. I can't do this anymore. It's killing me. I got to jump off of something, or it's got to be done. And I took the leap of faith, and I worked with my wife and my ex-wife, who had become friends, and some other friends, and figured out a way to get off the medication. It was like, we're going to get off and we're going to see where it goes. And it was pure insanity because I spent the next next 6 months in just such outrageous pain, I didn't know how I was going to do it. I didn't know what I was going to do or how I was going to do it. And I was able to find some alternative help with that. And, you know, again, that's where God really works in my life, as God has been there all the way through for me. There was a chiropractor, and he came to find out that my body didn't detox things properly, my liver was this or that, and basically helped me with this natural medication that helped my body to just clean itself of just general toxins that our body gets every day. And he says, this is going to help clean yourself out and make things better. And within about a month to 2 months, everything went from a constant 9 headache, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and feeling like I was going to completely throw up every moment of a day, to a 5 every day. And I wasn't really going to die anymore. It just felt a little bit better. So that was a big step. And with that came all of my friends in recovery, all being there for me, all being available. And we kept moving forward and moving forward and moving forward. You know, with the help of AA and many other 12-step programs, you know, I'm able to find my way and feel like a whole person again. Just as I had in early recovery, just as I had throughout recovery, I'm back to that place of finding wholeness within myself. And that's only through the steps. Only the steps have been able to help me find that. Coming to meetings, the support of everybody, all the people that were there for me, they were there for me all the while I was taking medication. They were there, it's going to be okay, we'll help you find a solution. Went to all the hospitals, went and did everything we could do. And they all supported me. And they all just stuck by me and says, somehow this is going to be okay. So continually as I went on, AA has been there, as well as many other 12-step programs that have just been there available for me. Another one is Al-Anon. Al-Anon has just been there as a central part of my recovery. Because again, Al-Anon along with the sister program of AA helps me to recognize the alcoholism that I grew up with and how to clean that up in my soul. And today what I can tell you is I don't feel like I live that shame anymore. I feel like I have a whole life with a wonderful family that I always wanted. And, you know, I remember my sponsor saying to me that you can't get life and then find spirituality. You have to find spirituality and life will come to you. And that's what I found to be so true. And I've had many moments of that throughout my recovery. It's been almost 30 years now from that 1981, that November 1981. And even in the midst of that medication and that insanity, recovery was always back there. Recovery was always inside of me. Recovery was always around me. And that's what saved me. Even in the midst of my insanity, the midst of my despair, there was always this something that said, there's possibilities, there's hope. Because I didn't pull that trigger. I didn't jump off of something. I kept hanging in there and hanging in there and hanging in there and talking about it and talking about it and talking about it. And every time I says, are you guys sick of hearing this? I says, we're not sick of hearing it. You know, we've heard it 100 times. That's okay. But if it helps you get through another day, that's all that matters. So anything is survivable in recovery. I've been through many deaths in recovery. Just as I had in my addiction, those people didn't stop dying when I came into recovery. My friend Andy, who came into recovery, was 5 years clean, got his master's degree, was doing fantastic. Later, it didn't go so well because he started doing other things again. And one day, his family found him in his apartment, you know, with, OD'd. And never really knew what happened to him. You know, my buddy Scott, you know, again, same thing. He was in that apartment for 4 days till anybody found him. You know, he didn't want to be alone. But yet he went and retreated to that apartment for the chemicals, and he died alone. When all we have to do is come to one of these rooms, and there's hope here every day for us. Every day there's hope. It never goes away. You know, there's a little saying that says, if God's missing in my life, who moved? Yeah. And I moved many times, but God has always been there. God has always been available. So I was very nervous here tonight telling this story and trying to figure out how I was going to fill up the time. And I spent more time in addiction than I did in recovery, I think, and I didn't want to do that. But hopefully, I just kind of talked about it as it came up in my mind. Hopefully, it was helpful to share that there's insanity, there's death, and there's goodness, and there's wonderment, and there's delight. It's all available to us. All of it. I have my choice. That's what my God allows me. He allows me my choice. And I can have all my misery funded free if I want to. Or I can continue to do what I'm doing and have the blessings that I experience today. Today I feel like a whole person. Today I feel like a worthwhile person. Today I feel like life is valuable to me. I appreciate your time. I appreciate you listening. I appreciate you having me here. Thank you.